I was just getting deeper and deeper and deeper every year. And they were happening more often. My mood swings and my emptiness, you know, it nearly became my default.
Right.
The odd day of happiness and trying to hide it became exhausting. And Joe Schmidt took over in 2013. I was in one of his camps. And I just called the doctor up to the room, Anna Falvey, and I said, I need help. You know, I'm in Irish camp. I'm in Carton House. You know, I have a child at home. Everything should be brilliant, but you know, I'm living in hell in my internal thoughts. And thankfully, I got help. I went and seen a psychiatrist in Cork, and I wouldn't leave his office until he gave me a pill. You know, first of all, he diagnosed me with bipolar, and he said, "Look, let's go off and see how you are for the next couple of weeks." And I was like, "No, I'm not leaving your office. I don't want to go back out, and unless you can fix me." And you know, in a way, the pill, you know, obviously, being prescribed medication, it was I was delighted to get it. But then, as I was starting to research, you know, over the couple of years, I was like, I felt bad. I felt ashamed of taking medication for a mental health, and I went off it, you know, cold turkey. And Edel was kind of, I told no one about it, and Edel was starting to ask me questions. She says herself, she could see it in my eyes. She could see I was changing. And you know, and that tour in Ar to Argentina in 2014, I was supposed to go on. I was trying to get out of a rut, and I ended up, I suppose, going on a bit of a bender. You know, trying to get a bit of happiness.
Yeah.
Get the worst thing ever you can do is come off medication, cold turkey, and go drinking. You know, and following day, I just woke up, and you know, I was in tears, and we were due to go on tour 2 days later, and I was like, maybe this is just a bad hangover, but it wasn't. You know, this was another cry for help, and I eventually broke down to Dell and told her I'd come off medication, rang the doctor, spoke to Joe Schmidt, and you know, he told me, look, get yourself right. That's the most important thing.
Even 2015 World Cup, famous win over France, everyone remembers. So this is 2 years after the diagnosis. And so that morning, that game, and that aftermath sounds horrific. Horrific. Like none of us had any idea where you were, really. None of us had a clue where you were. Your memory of that day.
That week, you know, we playing against Romania and Canada, and it was grand. We were winning, and you know, I was playing quite well. And then Joe, even myself and Ian Henderson, I remember there was obviously the media was kicking up a fuss. The two of us were going well, and we'd been rested for the French game. So Jarrod Payne was in at 13. I'd been playing a bit of wing and 13, and Jarrod Payne got injured, and on the Thursday I ended up slotting into 13. And I had prepared, but it just triggered a lot of anxiety. It was just a change, like, you know, and I didn't deal with it well. Like the sickness in the pit of my stomach with nerves. And even Edel meeting me that morning, she goes, "What is, like, I was sweating, I was white as a ghost, and didn't want to be there. I literally would have easily taken a flight home back to Shannon and stayed in Limerick and never to be seen again." And I kind of manifested all these, you know, bad scenarios that, you know, never thought I was good enough, and you know, always thinking the worst, that I was going to make a mistake. And I did make a big mistake in that game. You know, Tommy Bowen made a beautiful break, and I knocked on the ball, and everything I was thinking was happening, and it was all bad stuff. And I was in a brutal place. I can't describe it.
Yeah, because you mentioned tears before the game, trembling, and then you say, and it was the line, I don't know, it's just one of those lines in the book where I thought, God, where after the game you go back into the cubicle cursing just everything with frustration, like just why me? Like what the hell is this? And then the sentence in the book is, then I went back out and I showered and joined the lads and pretended nothing was wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember straight in, I even had kind of tears in my eyes walking around the pitch. I was like, I felt like crap. Like, you know, I went into the dressing room, straight into the cubicle. The boys were outside cheering. You know, it was an unbelievable win. Like, yeah. Like hammered France. And I was inside, effing and blowing. Couldn't figure out why. Like, you know, how I was feeling so bad, and I had enough of it. I, you know, how all my teammates were, you know, they had unbelievable tournaments, and, you know,
best days of their lives, really.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, wiped away the tears and went back out and, you know, had a beer. And even though I was internally in a dark place.
It's amazing you were able to play rugby at all, really, around then, isn't it?
Yeah, because I wasn't getting any release from, you know, it was driving me, it was worse, it was adding to all my anxiety and all my worthless feelings, you know, and I just cracked on with it. You know, it was tough, 7 days of the week, it was tough, and then the physical side of things was taking its toll as well, so yeah, I don't know how I got through it, really.
Anya, we've seen some truly terrible, terrible tragedies over the last few years that I'm sure play in the minds of women all the time. I think back to the murder of Jill Maher in Australia, which was, almost a decade ago at this stage. And, you know, more recently in London, the kidnapping and the murder of Sarah Everard. Again, both of those were the night out, something that there would always have been a fear about. And go back to that thing of be careful when you're out. I suspect if this had happened at 10 o'clock at night, we would have been having a conversation around providing safe spaces for women to go running, to lighting up GA grounds and lighting up running tracks and all of that. This, because it was the middle of the day, you know, beautiful sunny afternoon on a path where obviously there were a lot of other people around at the time. It's just another layer of a worse nightmare being played out in real life. And do you feel it's going to have an impact on the psyche of Irish women over the coming weeks and months in terms of how they approach their everyday life?
Yes, unfortunately. I think it just brings it into sharpened radical focus for us again. And the danger is that the conversation could only go there, you know, environmental things that could be done, as Orla talked about there. And if that was the only, and there is a place for that conversation, better lighting, better policing, of course. But we will have done each other, our society, our colleagues, our friends, our family, such a disservice. And we will not have respected, unfortunately, the young life of Aisling Murphy if we don't try to push on with learnings and to lead with empathy. And to your texters earlier, Ciarán, like, I take that. It is a given here that we know it is not all men. That is a given, that this is a minority of men. But not all men are change agents. Not all men are stepping up as male allies. And what I say to men tonight, as you reflect on those acts of violence, those murders, those missing women in this country through decades, is if you do nothing else over the next 24 to 48 hours, just sit down and ask a colleague or ask your mother or ask your sister or ask an aunt, ask some women in your life, what are their experiences? And just listen and trying to understand that lived reality that we have and start there at some simple, tangible level. And then see, are there simple, quantifiable things that you can do in terms of your language with your own children in the home, when it comes to the workplace, when it comes to our behavior, our conduct in nightclubs, when we get back to that life, when it comes to our college experiences, when it comes to being out and about in our communities. This ultimately boils down to our safety. We all deserve to walk out our doors in the morning, go for a walk, go for a run, go to work, go to a nightclub, and not have to constantly second guess everything and live with that sometimes spoken, sometimes unspeakable fear that we carry. So that's all I can appeal to men to do tonight, is just try to listen and lead with empathy. And maybe with that listening and that opportunity with people you love and you know and respect, some change may come. It could be simply in the language, what we say to our kids when they're going out to the nightclub. It may come for some men tonight going and looking up the Men's Development Network or looking up the work of the National Women's Council and deciding, I think I have something I can contribute, there's something I can do. Or it could be someone who's going to be in a boardroom next week and you're going to put your hand up and speak on behalf of women. Like, there's going to be some way tonight every man can play a part in the smallest of ways. And I know Orla probably feels pessimistic tonight. I can't lean into that. I can't, as a woman at 39 years of age, raising a child who is 3 and a half, not believe that we are better than this and that men are going to have our backs here. And I know not all men will be persuaded of it. We just need a majority to help us be the change they want to see in the world around them. And that today, unfortunately, in these most tragic circumstances, that this can be a marker and we can respect the tragic death of Aisling Murphy. And I hope in the years to come that some of this will have to come top down from our government, our policymakers. And I know there's a lot of good people in government who believe in a lot of the things we're talking about tonight, and they can lead by example too, while those of us further down the food chain can lead differently in our day-to-day lives. And it will take that cross-sectoral, will take all of our family conversations, but it will take it also at the highest levels of government to lead on Change Now and initiatives.
What a reaction from Real Madrid.
Very interesting. 2-2 in aggregate. No way goals, of course. So we are level. Who'd you fancy on penalties?
Oh,
Vinicius in again.
Oh, Real Madrid have scored. It's Benzema. Oh, my God.
Oh my God.
What just happened?
What are we saying about you can't get excited about these Champions League games anymore?
Oh my God. 3-1 Real Madrid, 2 goals in 2 minutes. Oh, Karim Benzema with a hat trick.
What have they done, Joe?
What a finish. First time finish.
Outside of the right foot.
Oh.
Just nonchalant, just kind of punched it into the corner of the net.
What will stick with everybody after this isn't even the attacking football and some of the brilliant matches we've seen. It was that moment when Christian Eriksen fell to the ground and everybody feared for the worst. And thankfully, the wonders of modern medicine and science kicked in and Christian Eriksen is still with us at 29 years of age, will go on and will live. You went through a similar incident, you were telling me off air, a couple of years back. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, no, it was very striking seeing Christian Eriksen. It was very traumatic and very vivid, I think. And what struck me was not so much, because at the time looking at it on the TV, you know, I thought Christian Eriksen had died. You know, I got the impression he may have died, you know. Wasn't sure, but the question mark was there, you know. And I think Damien Duff and Jackie Horley and Liam Brady were in the studio and they were, you know, shaking, yeah. And I think definitely, and it brought back to my own situation, of course, which, you know, I've not spoken about before, which was 2 years ago, of course, and more or less it was, you know, we played with the Ireland under-21s, we played Sweden, and in Sweden, away game, and we won 3-1, it was a great... great performance, you know. Troy Parrott scored 2 goals. The following morning, you know, we went and get on the flight. I wasn't feeling well on the bus going to the airport, and at Glaxo Airport, which where we were flying from, you know, I had a not too similar incident than Christian Eriksen. The similar incident, you know, it was quite an ordeal.
Right. So, in terms of the similarities, a heart issue.
Yeah. Listen. I just said at the time the doctor Ronan Kearney, he was our under-21 doctor, but funnily enough, he chose that weekend to get married.
Right.
Which is nice of him, you know. But I think so. We had a new doctor in that weekend. It was Mortimer O'Connor, who stepped up from the under-17s from Cork, and. You know, so it was a baptism of fire for Mortimer, and he did brilliantly. I think, you know.
So what happened?
I was just it was a, you know, obviously I wasn't feeling well, and I just really collapsed, I suppose. You know, the of course, I've been informed since, you know, obviously, to Dr. Mortimer and Damien Doyle, the fitness coach, provide, you know, done CPR, and I got to, Damien had to do CPR while the doctor got the defibrillator and so forth, and the paramedics in the airport were on the scene very quickly, and all of the players had gone through. We was scheduled flights, it wasn't a charter flight, the under-21s. So all the players had gone through and some staff, so it was just a certain number of staff had stayed with myself because they knew I wasn't well. And then when that happened, obviously none of the players didn't see it because they were gone through to the other side to get the flight. So, but there was a sort of big scene at the airport, all right. And
so you collapsed suddenly?
I did, yeah. It was traumatic enough at the time for everyone. For me, looking at sort of Christian Eriksen's situation, it impacted me because I realised, you know, I got serious flashbacks because I seen the impact I had on the people around the situation at the time. So lucky enough, I had, you know, people around me who were my staff and colleagues and friends, you know, Keith Andrews, Jim Crawford, Damien Doyle, and fitness coach, was there, Colm O'Neill, who was a physical therapist. They were all in the vicinity at the time, and a lot of people in the vicinity. So we were all trying to address the situation. Obviously, it was very, very serious because I hadn't realised, of course, you know. Mm.
Had your heart stopped?
They couldn't get a pulse. They couldn't get a heartbeat. So apparently I'd, you know, turned blue. So it was a serious situation. So I think it was just a blockage of electricity to the heart, the flow of electricity to the heart. And I think one of the, like Jim Crawford said to me at the time, or the following morning, I'm not going to lie to you, Stephen, I thought you were dead, you know, and I thought you were gone. And Kieran Crowley, my press officer at the under-21s, he got on the flight with the players. And he said at the time that he got on the flight for an hour and a half, and he said it was the longest flight of his life, that he got on the flight and they were on the flight and he wasn't sure, he thought it might be dead. So
waiting to land and see what the text would say.
Waiting to land, yeah, exactly. So I'm very grateful. I had great medical care. Mortimer, the doctor, O'Connor, done brilliant. All of the staff, Keith Andrews was amazing, Jim Crawford, Damien Doyle, Fergus, you know, our kit man, they were all around, Colm O'Neill, Kevin Mulholland. So all the people around.
They've been able to tell you what they did, how they reacted?
Yeah, well, what happened really was once I seen the Christian Eriksen situation last week, I'd sort of reflected on it and I started just ringing them and wondering how it affected them because, you know, it revisited. We nearly moved on from it, all of us. And, you know, and I just was saying, you know, how did it affect you? And how, you know, what was the impact? And they all had their sort of anecdotal stories in that they didn't think that, you know, that I was going to survive at that time. And so it was, you know, it was quite traumatic.
Now we're getting there. We obviously had some big names there, some of the biggest names in world sport paying tribute. One of them, though, wasn't just satisfied with the little few words of niceties. One of them wanted to pay proper, old-fashioned Irish tribute to a great man in J.P. Gilburn.
Usually on a night out, I would usually sing a song anyway at the end of a night, and I just tried to rejig the words of one of my favourite songs. So here goes. I'll sing this, J.P., just for you. Good luck with everything. Here goes. Dear Jer, I write this note to you to tell you of me plight. I am just sick of working with this shower of shite. My body is all black and blue, my face a deathly grey. And I write this note to say why JP's not at work today. While working on the second floor, some shite I had to clear. Now to throw it down from such a height was not a good idea. The foreman, Barry, wasn't pleased, he'd been an awkward sod. He said I'd have to cart it down a ladder on a hod.